Welcome to the Wealth Planning for the Modern Physician podcast, where we talk to doctors like you about their real-world lessons in financial matters and hear from industry experts who can impact your personal bottom line. The host of our podcast is David Mandel. David is an attorney, OJM group partner, and author of more than a dozen books on wealth planning for physicians. Now, let's turn the mic over to David.
Hello, this is David Mandel, host of the podcast. Welcome to today's program. I'm excited about today's guest. He's somebody that has worked with OJM, and I've heard him speak, and I've read his books, and really interesting stuff, especially for all of you physician listeners who play some management role, and I think that's probably most of you. You have employees in your practice, you have a team around you, whether it's in the OR or in front of the waiting room or somewhere in the practice. So this stuff is really relevant for you, and it's been helpful for our team at OJM. So I think you're going to get a lot out of it. So let me tell you about Frank Maselli, and then we will bring him on. Frank Maselli is a three-time best-selling author and award-winning keynote speaker across the country. He's a former U.S. Army officer and three-decade veteran of the profession. Frank has been an advisor, a top branch manager, and the executive vice president for one of the largest and most successful asset management firms in the world. Frank has trained tens of thousands of employers. His expertise covers a range of broad range of skills, but he is most renowned for his work on modern marketing, client psychology, and advanced presentation skills. His programs are cutting edge, exciting, and his delivery is mind-blowing. And I would tell you that is true. So with that, Frank, welcome to the program.
Thank you, David. Mind-blowing. I love that phrase. That's so good.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, when you came and worked with us after we'd seen you speak, I just thought it was so interesting. I am interested in psychology and why people do things the way they do and how to get the most out of your people. And that is something I think a lot of physicians struggle with day to day, because what we're going to talk about, I think we can guarantee that they don't cover this in medical school or in fellowship or any kind of medical training. So all of a sudden these docs come out and they have to deal with people, which we can't avoid in what we do, and they have no training in it. So hopefully they can learn a couple of nuggets today and maybe even find some interest to go down a more in-depth path.
Sure.
So before we get into some of that, tell us first about your professional background beyond the short bio, and how do you help businesses today, including potentially medical practices?
Sure. Well, my background is lengthy. I've been around a long time. I started in the military after college, and I ended up getting a doctorate in psychology, and that's become my specialty. And I try to weave psychology. I agree with you. I think psychology is the underlying driver behind everything we do and how we succeed professionally. So much of my world, I ended up going to Wall Street, been on Wall Street for about 40 years now. And so much of that is numbers related, but the heart of it is the mind, is the heart and the mind of clients, how we make decisions, how we make good and bad decisions. And as leaders, I became a manager fairly quickly in my career. And as leaders, we're challenged, being a manager, being a leader of a team, whether it's a large team or a small team, that's tremendously emotion driven. And those skills are not taught. I mean, they're taught a lot in the military, but strangely enough, the military is a very advanced leadership training proving ground. Most people don't understand that. They think of the movies and they think of Patton and yelling and screaming, right. But it's not like that at all. Anyway, long story short, that's been my background. I try to help people now understand some of the depth behind leadership and management, and how to dig a little further with their people and how to understand what motivates and inspires their people. So it's kind of fun.
That's great. And we've had a number of physicians with military backgrounds training in our podcast, actually. And it is funny that I think especially when Matt Provenger was on, and I'm thinking Jen also, they talked about what they learned in terms of leadership and working in a team as part of what they took away. So that's not surprising that you'd mention that. So let's talk about the value of using an assessment test when you think about hiring and managing a team. Some people have probably heard about this all the way back from, you know, what color is my parachute when they start their career or something like that. But give us sort of broad, you know, 30,000 foot view of assessment tests, what you think of them, and you know how they can be used.
I have a love-hate relationship with assessment tests, and I think a lot of people do. I think they sometimes can scare folks, and there's so much misunderstanding about assessment tests. But I recommend some of them specifically for managers, for leaders, to get a better handle on their people, what makes their people tick. And we talked about this certainly in our meeting, but there are many, there are many, many hundreds of assessment tests. There's a handful of them that I think really do help. But you've got to understand them. And the benefit of an assessment, very simply, there's two real benefits. First of all, it kind of quantifies some of the behaviors that people exhibit on the job and in life in general, personality behaviors, instinctive behaviors, knowledge. So the quantification is important. But the second benefit is that it helps the leader or the manager take the interview process out of that natural communication thing, where we all want to be impressed and impressive, and people have learned how to interview really, really well. I mean, anybody that doesn't give a good interview is just not prepared today. So you want to get deeper than the interview. You want to get beyond the fluff and beyond what the resume says. And that's where assessment tests can help, because it really does put a spotlight on certain issues. So I use them for those two reasons, to help the manager quantify and to dig beyond the, you know, the nonsense that comes out, because people know what to say. They know what to say in a job interview.
Right.
And then suddenly 6 months later, you've got a completely different person in front of you and you're wondering what the heck happened to this person. So it's funny. We cut through that nonsense.
I know we've talked about this before, but explain to the audience, what is the three-part mind and how does that kind of take, how does that show up in a workplace environment?
Yeah, that's a fascinating concept. This is something I learned many years ago from a brilliant woman named Kathy Colby, and we'll talk about her in a second. But the three-part mind is basically three. There are three elements, and I try to think of it in terms of an iceberg. If you picture an iceberg, okay, the very top of the iceberg, the part that you can see from 50 miles away, that's knowledge. That's very fleeting. It's stuff that you learn. It's stuff that's acquired quickly and sometimes dispersed quickly. The middle of the iceberg, still above the water level, is personality. So knowledge and personality are both above the water level. Personality are desires, emotions, how you feel about certain things, your values and your beliefs. Below the waterline is the third part of the mind. And this is the part that fascinated the heck out of me, and it's really become a driver for many of the things that I teach. Below the waterline are instinctive behaviors. These are hardwired characteristics that are formed very, very early in life. Some say from birth, some say from early childhood. And they end up being permanent attributes or behaviors or characteristics that the person carries with them their entire life. And that's where I try to spend the majority of my time in coaching managers and leaders, to help them understand the behaviors, not the desires. People don't always do what they know how to do or what they want to do. They sometimes do, they very often do, what they're driven to do internally.
Yeah.
And those behaviors manifest, regardless of knowledge, in many cases, or personality. So those are the three parts: personality, knowledge, and then instinctive behaviors. And we want to get below the waterline with your employees as fast as you can.
Because the concern is that, or is by understanding those kind of instinctive drives, that you'll be able to better predict what kind of behavior they'll have and what kind of fit, you know, what position would fit that kind of instinct in a good way.
That's exactly correct. It's all those things. What kind of person are you dealing with? How will they handle the job that they've been given? Okay. Not so much a question of are they the right person for the job, but how will they best succeed on that job? I very rarely use instincts as the final determinant as to who to hire for a specific job. What I use it more for is coaching people who are on a job already.
Yeah.
And I would say, let's find the best way for you to succeed in that role. And for things for me to do to coach you in that role. How should I manage you? And I'm a big believer in managing everybody differently. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about this in the military. We treat people with fairness, but everyone is unique. And so we have to learn how to lead and manage each individual according to their needs, not according to our needs. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It's designed for fit. It's designed for performance. It's designed for also for failure. When you have somebody who's struggling, you want to know why and maybe how that can be corrected, if it can be corrected. In some cases, it may not be correctable, frankly. Yeah. But instincts will drive you toward that solution, I think.
So you mentioned Mary Colby.
Right? Kathy Colby.
Kathy Colby. Yeah, my mistake. And I know this is something that we, we'll get into this, that OJM partook in. She developed a test that you work with, a sort of index measure. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's actually called the Colby A Index, K-O-L-B-E. Okay. And Kathy's just unbelievable genius. And she basically came to the conclusion many, many years ago that personality and knowledge were not enough to define a human's performance. There had to be something else. And she developed a very simple but powerful test called the A Index, and it identifies a person's instinctive natural strengths and behaviors in four categories. The first category is called fact finder, which is how a person processes information, how they take in information, how they give out information. Second category is called follow through, which is how a person deals with structure and organization and discipline. Third category is called quick start, which is how an individual deals with changing situations, new ideas, and innovation. And the fourth category is called implementer, which is how a person interacts with the physical environment. And this is fascinating because in my profession, in the financial world, we get very, very few implementers.
Yeah.
But in the general population, there's a huge dispersion of implementers. Physical people, dancers, artists, architects, construction folks, carpenters, that kind of stuff.
Right.
It's a fascinating instinctive pattern.
And this has been a couple of years, but I remember one of the things that really I took away from what we did was, we all did the test at OJM Group, and mm-hmm. it was really really interesting, but also I think comforting that we all came out pretty much, I think we were like 90% fact finding. I mean, fact finder bias. I know it's not all one or the other, right? But each of us, like myself, we were all, I think with some of the things, as a marketing person, I was thinking, how could we market that? Because what you want someone managing your assets or someone, managing your health, you want somebody who looks at evidence. You want somebody who's, conservative that way, that goes with what the data shows. Right. That doesn't get too emotional, isn't going to jump on every new idea, right? Which I think a lot of clients would love to know. Oh, these people, their instinct is actually pretty conservative or balanced or evidence-based, et cetera. I would like to know that about my lawyer or physician or money manager. It's hard to get that word out, but that was very comforting for us, but it was interesting. And then there were a couple folks on our team that, were a little bit biased one way, but I do remember, I don't think we had any physical people on our team.
I don't think so.
Which wasn't surprising given what we do, but I found that to be really fascinating. Tell us your thoughts on that, or what you remember, without any details. But is that kind of a typical analysis you go through with a small firm to kind of do the tests on all the key people, and then talk about what we have to look out for that?
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. We have the entire team take the test, and then we do a quick, an in-depth analysis as much as they can handle. But your team was very homogeneous. You had a lot of the fact finder. You had quite a bit of follow through. Very little quick start, and virtually no implementer.
Right.
Not uncommon. That's fine. There's nothing wrong. Oh, and by the way, this is important. There is no good or bad Colby score.
Right.
There's no high or low. There's no good or bad. They're all good. It's just knowing what your score is. That's the most important thing. But to have a team that's homogeneous, especially in FactFinder, means you're going to have a very high degree of accuracy, precision, analytics, thoughtfulness. The challenge with a team like that may come in the communication mode, where no one on the team naturally simplifies concepts. They all make things more complicated, perhaps, than necessary, or maybe analysis paralysis. You've right. heard that expression. People overthink things, and they want more data, better data, more accurate data, more up-to-date data. You can find an organization like that sometimes, or a team like that, gets paralyzed. They get frozen with an inability to make decisions. Making decisions quickly, that's a quick start instinct.
Right. Okay. We have one of those on our team. So yeah.
No, do you? All right. Yeah, I don't. Yeah. Was that
you? I won't name names, but we have one who is pretty high on that. Yeah. So now, That balances us out a bit, though, which is good, right? Because we don't want the analysis paralysis. And again, right. like you said, it wasn't. Our numbers weren't. I think it's a 10 scale. It wasn't like 10-0, right? It was
right.
It was balanced towards or leaning towards analysis, right. but not. Paralysis, ideally.
Not paralysis. No. And that quick start would be the born in the group that says, okay, guys, we've overthought this. Let's just take some action. Let's make right. a decision. Right. Quick starts like to make decisions
right.
and adjust on the fly, which is kind of an interesting trait right. as well.
Right.
But there is a need in an organization for almost every one of these instincts. Right. And in an ideal world, it would be a balanced team, but
right.
it doesn't work that way. So knowing is more important than the numbers themselves. It's fascinating.
It's really interesting. I mean, we could talk about this the whole time. I mean, I loved what sure. we did on that. And I think we had a couple people that were kind of even across the board. They were almost like, you know, in the middle on all the categories, which is a unique position, you know, in its own right.
That's a fascinating set of scores. Colby calls those mediators or facilitators. That's a person who can parachute into any team, into any situation, and be instinctively comfortable and effective in that group. It's a really great, I don't want to use that right. effective term, but it's a very useful skill set.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think we had one of those too. So how does this test, the Colby A index measure, how does that relate to other tests like what people have heard, like Myers-Briggs or IQ or some of these other tests out there? Obviously, we were already talking about how it's a little bit different, but give us some specifics about it.
Well, again, the Colby is the only test that measures that third part of the mind, that sub under the water instinctive level. So the Myers-Briggs, the DISC, the Enneagram, Strengths Finders, you know, Predictive Index. These tests are what they call affective tests, which is personality. Affective is a loose word for personality. 99% of the tests out there are personality tests, which are important. And I think a Myers-Briggs is a very useful set of scores to understand and to know what drives somebody on a personality level. But think about this. One of the measures that we use is persistency of test scores. One of the things that we identify is what's called test retest validity. So a person takes an assessment test, they wait a certain period of time, they take the same test again. How do the scores compare over that time period? The Myers-Briggs has a 40% retest validity over 4 weeks. What does that mean? You take a test today, you take it a month later, you've got a 60% chance of getting different scores on the Myers-Briggs. And that's the most popular personality test in the world. That's a very fleeting number. Your personality can shift over time. The Colby has a 90% test retest validity over 10 years. We're identifying permanent hardwired characteristics. The totality of the individual are those three parts of the mind. So you don't want to just identify one element of the individual. You want to identify as much as you can. And so the combination of knowledge, personality, and instincts is what gives you as much information as you can possibly get from assessment tests.
Yeah, that makes sense. And one of the reasons we thought it was so important to do that. It sounds like, I mean, the instinctive, within a range, that's pretty set, like you said, kind of hardwired, where personality might depend on your mood that day, how things went that week. Not completely, not 100%, but you may be a little more positive 1 week versus another, and that may show up in that kind of test. Is that kind of what you're saying? And
that's absolutely correct. I mean, your personality can be affected by so many forces. And I'll give you a great example. I mean, think about how the national personality has shifted over the last 24 months.
Right.
I mean, if you think about just the optimism level in our country, and you know, we could spend days talking about this, but things have shifted quite right. a bit. Things shifted for America dramatically. Personality took a dramatic shift after 9/11.
Yeah.
It was a big shock to our system.
Yeah.
Bottom line is you need to know more than that, but the Colby is not affected by external forces. It's purely an internal driver. And that's where the power is. I don't want to oversell this concept, yeah. but the power is knowing what that person will default to right. all the time,
right?
Because they can't escape those instincts. Those instincts don't change, and they always manifest.
So we talked a little about tools. Now let's talk a little bit about, like, you know, implementing or using them. So big picture, mm-hmm. you know, this broad question, but how can you go about hiring the right person for the job, right? How do you take that? Yeah. I mean, that's a big challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it is, and it's very, very costly to hire the wrong person.
For sure.
Costly in not only dollars, but in terms of emotional, you know, investment and time. Yeah. Time. Yeah. I mean, good God. So you want to make the best hiring decisions you can. And I try to use the assessment tests to help that process. Obviously, with experience, you kind of get a good sense of what people can deliver, but this gives me some concrete. This gives me something solid to think about. Now, a simple example, okay? If I'm hiring an administrative assistant for my office, I know what that job requires. That job requires somebody who's focused on detail, who does dot the I's and cross the T's, who doesn't let things go out with typos on them, who follows up on information and gets accurate information before they tell something to a client. So I know that I'm looking in Colby land. I know that I'm looking for a fact finder follow through. I don't necessarily need a quick start in that role. A quick start is somebody who's going to say, oh, you know what? Don't worry about the numbers. You just make them up. Yeah. And I laugh about that because that's my number. I'm a 10 in quick start, which is just a terrifying number to be a financial professional. Because when a client would ask me a question, I would say, oh, who the heck cares? Don't worry about that. That's not a good thing.
Right.
So what you want to do is you want to assess what the role you're hiring for requires. What do you believe as the boss that job requires? And then you want to match those behaviors up with the individual's instinctive strengths. And that's, you know, there are tests. There's a test process that you use in Colby, the A, the B, and the C, different tests for the boss to take, the leader to, you know, the manager, and then the individual takes the A. And so it's a process, but
yeah.
you know, it's very, very powerful. And what it prevents is those people that you hire because you like them or because they remind you of somebody or because they interview really well. And then 3-6 months later, you're going, oh my God, what a mistake this was. And then, you know, today it's impossible. It's almost impossible to, you know, to transition someone out of a role.
Right.
Very challenging. So you want to do the right job up front.
Absolutely. And I think if docs listening to this, you know, I mean, it's sort of, there's staff, of course, which is crucial, right? I mean, a medical practice is really only as good as its staff to some degree. I mean, obviously you want great physicians giving great care, but as a consumer of health, you know, if the staff is not good and just in terms of getting things done or getting the prescription out or following up and things like that, I mean, you have, you know, malpractice issues. You also just have people not being happy and then putting up bad reviews on Google. Mm. And, you know, it drives docs crazy. They're like, hey, I'm doing a good job for my patients, but I'm getting bad reviews. Well, maybe because of everybody but you, right? And mm-hmm. so it really does reflect the practice. But another thing I was just thinking about too is, you know, hiring in new docs, you know, I mean, those are partners, you know, potential partners. And when those things don't work out and there's so much turnover in medicine, especially in the first 5 years, you know, the numbers are pretty high, you know, part of that is, I think, from the young docs coming out, not really knowing what they're getting into. And there's a venture I'm working on with a couple of surgeons to hopefully improve that. But it also could be, you know, not hiring the right fit on the employer side too, and bringing in the wrong doc, even though they might be a great physician or well trained, it's not a fit for this particular practice. So,
well, yeah, that's a
go good ahead. I have no thoughts on that.
No. This is you're touching on something that's very critical, and I've worked with a lot of doctors. I was in the Army Medical Service Corps, which you know we interface with physicians every day, and I can't think of a more challenging profession than that, quite frankly. But your point being that when you create a team, you want a good fit on that team, because a bad fit, especially among partners, especially among professionals who are relative equals, can be an absolute nightmare.
Right.
You know, if you're going into the office every day dreading seeing your partner, that's just, you know, that's a formula for easy destruction right there.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah, it's not like, hey, if you have a staff member, you could fire them. I mean, there are certainly legal issues, right? This is not legal advice, but there is a way to eventually do that with performance, et cetera, for, you know, in most cases. But you can't always fire your partner. Right. That's, I mean, again, some partnership, you know, if there's egregious issues, of course,
right.
You know, but it just because they're just not a fit and make your life a living hell, that's not probably in the documents
you know, my theory is why go through that pain?
Right. You know, exactly.
You really don't
have to. House of prevention. I mean, you know, that's right. The whole thing, right? That's why we're talking here. That's why I want people to listen.
And by the way, just to not to interject, but if you have client facing staff people,
right,
that's a critical role.
Right.
I mean, you know, your organization is represented a lot of times by many other people besides the physician.
Right.
So those client facing people need certain skills as well that are pretty advanced.
That's exactly what I was, you know, trying to say. Right. Exactly right. Oftentimes they're the ones that make the difference between a good experience and a poor experience for the patient. Right. Is the staff they're facing. So how do the instincts come in? Let's say forget about not the team is hired. Let's say we're not looking to hire anybody new. We have our team in terms of coaching and improving performance. So you've got somebody, you're not looking to fill a new position, but you know, things could be better. You don't really want to start again and terminate and go out and find somebody. When you come in, what's your process and how do these tools help you to coach and improve performance with an existing team?
Great, great question, because you really don't want to make wholesale changes unnecessarily. It's better to take the people you have and to coach them into a better performing, existence on the team, more functional and better enjoyment. So we try to identify the roles that have been established. We look at the instinctive strengths. We look at the other, you know, the other aspects of the individual, and then we will make certain suggestions from a training perspective, in terms of skills. If skills are the problem, that's the easiest thing to fix. Generally, training can solve that. If instinctive mismatches are the challenge, we have a couple of choices right there. The first choice is to say to the person, "Hey, you know what? This is your job. Gut it up. Do it anyway." That's not the ideal choice. The ideal choice is to somehow tweak the role or the way the role is implemented on the team to make it more in line with the person's natural strengths. Simple example, okay? If I have somebody whose job is to do a lot of research and to make sure numbers are accurate and precise, but they have very little fact finder and follow through, what I would do to that person is I'd say, listen, I don't need you to do research all day long, but what I do need is I need a short amount, a burst of intense research every hour. I need you to do 10 minutes an hour on certain functions that you're not happy with. That may be a minor change, but that person's not during the course of the day, they're not doing 60 minutes of hard work. They're goofing off. They're ruining the entire day. If I can get 60 minutes of productive research out of a person, that would be a big, big improvement on the team, but I'm going to get it in smaller increments.
Right.
So for somebody whose job description is fixed and cannot be flexed in any way, I would begin to flex some of the terms of how that job is implemented for that individual. I would coach them to change the way they approach the job. I know this sounds a little complicated, but if I don't want to get rid of them,
right,
which is probably my last choice,
right,
then I want to help them do their job better in a way that fits their natural strengths better. And often those are very minor changes in the person's world. And so with minor tweaks, we can dramatically improve the performance of people on the team. It's really fun to watch the way that happens on a team. Right. It's very exciting.
Well, I think my guess would be not only are you getting some more productivity out of it, but you're also getting some more buy-in from the employee, because you're making an effort to, you know, understand them and carve around, or, you know, be flexible for their benefit. And I think people would appreciate that, you know, and so they'll totally. even if it's, you know, still not their core, you know, sort of instinct, they'll be willing to gut it out a little bit, because you're also giving a little bit on your end in terms of the role.
Yeah. I mean, and you used a critical word there, flexibility. Leadership flexibility is very, very important. And frankly, it's an advanced skill that not everybody learns. Yeah. You know, they learn that leaders have to be very didactic and, you know, dictatorial, and that doesn't work anymore. The other aspect too, which we sometimes get into, is reward systems. Yeah. If I know that somebody has a very, very difficult job that doesn't align with their natural strengths, I know they're in pain, but the job has to get done, I might construct a different reward system for that individual, a different compensation plan, a different, you know, time off plan.
Right.
For example, if I have an implementer on my team, which is that physical instinct,
right,
and that person needs to take a 2-hour lunch so they can go to the gym, I'm okay with that. They're much more productive than sitting at the desk all day long. That's a very challenging one to deal with, but it's also a pretty easy fix if you've got something like that. So once we know what the person's all about, then we can make customized changes for the team that really enhance performance.
Got it. Last question.
Sure.
This is sort of, you know, looking at the leader themselves, right? So now we're talking about the doc, the manager, et cetera, themselves. How critical is it? And I thought it was, and I'll just put my 2 cents in, I thought it was so interesting and critical for us to do it and for me to do it for myself. But, you know, how important is for these folks to, you know, do the test themselves, right? And understand where they're coming from and how, what their own instincts are. Is that step number one typically? Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's step zero. We start with that. Before we even talk to the group, we have the leadership team take the assessment. And then that does a few things. First of all, it tells me what kind of challenges we're going to have in terms of implementing change on the team. And secondly, it helps me understand how best to communicate with that leader. But it's absolutely life and death essential for the leader to understand their natural strengths before we can go into the team.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's so valuable to understand what makes that leader work. And it's not surprising, wouldn't surprise you at all to know that sometimes people hire people who are exactly like themselves.
Right.
That's not always the best function for a team, you know? Right. But you're right. The short answer is the leader has to do it. And often we do it first before we even agree to a consult.
Makes sense. And I really enjoy doing it. And for all the listeners out there, this is, you know, a topic that you may not have thought about a lot before. I mean, you probably thought about headaches that your team's giving you, mm-hmm. right? We all do that, right? Because we got to deal with people. But in terms of what do I do about it other than hiring, firing, how to get a little bit deeper, how to get a little bit more thoughtful and not make the same mistakes over and over as leaders, and how to be, you know, even more productive and more harmonious. This kind of tool and this kind of expertise that Frank has, I'd really encourage you folks to think about this kind of assessment and diagnostic in your own practice. So Frank, in sort of our last question, if docs were interested, what resources do you have? Obviously, we'll put your bio and your email in the show notes so they can get a hold of you. But what are the kind of things that you would tell them to take as a next step to get educated? And how do you work with folks?
I work in a very customized way with my teams. It's there is no, you know, formula. There's no Maselli program that they have to ascribe to, but it's completely customized. Just reach out to me, shoot me an email, pick up the phone, and we can talk. And every team is a little different. And I try to blend my style with theirs and find the best approach. But yeah, just shoot me an email and we can talk and figure out what, you know, what your challenges are and what your needs are. But I do this every day. So it's kind of it's a deep passion of mine, helping people succeed like this.
For sure. And we're out there looking to hire somebody potentially at OJM, and we're certainly going to use some of these tools to make the right decision or the best decision we can make.
That's great.
Yep. Frank, so thanks so much for being on. I think this is great. I hope everybody learned some things, and I'm sure they did. And with that, I ask all the listeners, tune in again every 2 weeks and tell all your friends. Thanks. Thanks, Frank. Thanks for being on.
Thanks, David. Take care.
Thanks for listening. The Wealth Planning for the Modern Physician podcast is brought to you by OJM Group, a multidisciplinary wealth management firm dedicated to helping physicians build and preserve their wealth while reducing taxes. Podcast listeners can get a free copy of our newest book, Wealth Planning for the Modern Physician. Simply text WPPOD to 844-418-1212 and click the link in the reply text to request your free print copy or ebook download. Be sure to join David for the next episode of the podcast. It's important to note that this content is for informational purposes only and does not represent personalized investment advice, as the information may not be suitable for your personal circumstances. Please contact your investment advisor before implementing any of the strategies discussed.